This is James Stoker. I'm talking today with Donald Hayes. We're really happy to have you here.
Thank you, James. Yeah. And it's a pleasure to have you here in sunny California.
Great. First of all, why don't you tell me a little bit about your early life? Where were you born and where did you grow up?
Okay, I was born in Wayne, Pennsylvania in 1929, December 29, just a couple months after the big crash.
Oh.
My father worked for a Beechnut Packing Company as a salesman for a number of years. There were cutbacks, and we had to pack up and move the family back to his hometown in Crafton, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I really grew up in Crafton, went to grade school there, high school. In the course of my high school days, there was, of course, talk about what career do you want to go into. I had two uncles who were in the accounting area, were very successful at it. I was pretty good at math, and so we put two and two together and decided I should go to Duquesne University, take business administration and major in accounting. And that's how we selected accounting. And
were you ever tempted by any other career paths?
In high school, I was fascinated, of course, by sports, where I participated in baseball, tennis, and hockey, but I quickly figured out I could go nowhere in those other than to have some fun. But I was also fascinated by astronomy. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about that, but again, I thought about you work all night, you don't make much money, mm-hmm. and accounting sounds much better, so I chose that course.
Right. Now, did you join the Air Force before or after college?
I joined it after, when I went to Duquesne University, they had the ROTC program, so I joined that and took 4 years of ROTC Air Force training. The Korean War started midpoint through my college days. However, being in ROTC, I was able to continue on and graduate, and then became a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force, mm-hmm. from 52 to 54. Had some interesting experiences there.
Did your duties there involve accounting at all, or were they?
Yes, they did. I was eventually stationed at a Air Force depot in Topeka, Kansas, that of course handled the Air Force supplies for that part of the country, and they had cost accounting systems, inventory control systems, and things like that. Which the controller there said, you're the man to deal with this. Mm-hmm. So I got into those kinds of systems. I was there when the Air Force put its inventory records on dollars.
Oh, wow.
Prior to that, the government had inventory records in terms of quantities, but no dollar value attached to it. Mm-hmm. So I went to a training course the Air Force put on how to put all this data on IBM punch cards, and price it out, and come up with the dollar value of the inventory at the depot.
Wow.
None of us knew what it was going to be. We had guesses what it might be. It turned out to be $85 million or something like that, which back then, of course, was real money. And I got a good experience there. But after the two-year period there, I wanted to get back and give public accounting a try.
Understandably. Did you already have a job before you finished your time in the Air Force? Or?
No. Right at the end of my Air Force days, I started to send out resumes to the large accounting firms in Pittsburgh. I would say five of the Big Eight. So by the time I got back to Pittsburgh, I had responses from, I think, four of the firms that says, yes, come in and talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that and selected Arthur Young & Company as the firm I wanted to start with.
Okay, so Arthur Young was your first job in right after the Air Force?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. And that was in 1954?
That was in 54.
Okay. And then you worked there for 2 years before you took the CPA examination?
In Pennsylvania, you were required to have 2 years' experience to take the CPA exam, and I did that and had the good fortune to pass the exam on the first try.
Mm-hmm.
Back then in Pennsylvania, under their CPA rules, you had to pass the entire exam in one try or start all over again. Mm-hmm. Other states would permit you to pass a part and take other parts, but Pennsylvania required you to take the whole thing, so I breathed a very deep sigh of relief when we found out I'd passed the whole thing.
I can imagine. Yeah. So what were you doing during those years in Pennsylvania? What was the work of a junior auditor like?
Okay. You start from the bottom, of course, and you start with very detailed work, which some junior auditors say is kind of boring. But that's where you have to start to learn the ropes. So in a typical audit, we would start what we call interim work sometime during the year, for example, August, September, October. And at that point in time, we were auditing the internal control system and also doing a limited amount of work on what had transpired for, let's say, the 8 months up to that date. The purpose of doing interim work was to ascertain whether the internal control system was functioning properly and also to take the load off the end of the year. After going through that phase, then, of course, we'd come back at the end of the year, December, January, February, and complete the audit. Mm-hmm. The year-end work would be, of course, to go down the balance sheet accounts, starting with cash, reconcile bank accounts, count petty cash, mm-hmm. receivables, confirm them, check collectibilities, mm-hmm. Receivables based on agings, inventory, observe the counting of inventory, usually December 31st, often required you to miss your New Year's Eve wow. party and go to some cold place in Pennsylvania or elsewhere to test count inventories. Mm-hmm. Also, of course, we would take into account obsolescence to make sure inventories were lower cost or market. Deferrals and prepaid, make sure the matching process is being properly followed and that items that should be expensed were not being deferred, for example, such as advertising. Mm-hmm. We called them fixed assets back then, but it's property, plant, and equipment today. The major items purchased by the company would be vouched. We would look at the invoices and so forth and back them up and make sure that nothing was being capitalized as property, plant, and equipment other than an asset that would be usable over a period number of years. On the other side of the balance sheet at the end of the year, we look at accounts payable, make sure they were all in the books, look at invoices that came in after the end of the year, like in January, to make sure none of those related to December items, and if they were, we'd make sure they got recorded. Accruals of all sorts, like vacation pay, warranties, pension costs, taxes, we would look at the makeup of those accounts and determine that the accrual on the books was proper. Long-term debt, if the company had some, we confirm that with the trustee, and also check the loan indentures behind the long-term debt to make sure that if there were dividend restrictions, we knew what they were and they would be disclosed in the financial statements. Contingent liabilities, which are usually footnote matters, were handled by getting legal letters from the law firms and also reading the corporate minutes to make sure that there were no legal actions referred to there.
And at this time, all of this was done on paper, right? You didn't
all
have the
this,
advantage of personal computers?
No or... personal computers. This was all on work papers, and we would have a really big stack on
it. Okay. Did you have a secretary that would help you out with all this stuff, all this paperwork, or were you the secretary?
as a junior, you do everything from get coffee to do the most basic stuff and cart around the work papers. When you're there as a senior, then you have some juniors working for you
right.
who can get the coffee and help keep the work papers filed and things like that.
Absolutely.
The only account I didn't mention here, capital stock, of course, you look at that to make sure that any dividends paid were authorized by the minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The income statement we look at to make sure there were no unusual trends. We would look at general administrative expense because you never know what's going to be dumped in there. We would look at income taxes to make sure they were properly calculated. For large engagements, there would be other Arthur Young offices involved, so we'd have information flown in from the other offices to put together with the local statements for consolidation. For some clients, we would actually make up the statements ourselves because the client relied on us to do that. For most of them, however, they made up their own statements, and then we would tie our information into the client's statement.
Okay.
Then we would participate in the preparation of the annual report, which looked like this one on Chevron I have in my hand here, except not as thick. Go to the printer with them, make sure everything proofread properly.
How long was a typical annual statement at this time?
I would say it was probably no more than 15 or 20 pages.
Whereas this book you have in your hand
this book I have in my hand, I think it's about 90.
Mm-hmm.
About 90 pages, and I was just curious, and I counted the footnotes in the Chevron statement. It's 26 notes over 30 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not counting the management's discussion and analysis of 20 pages. And the information on oil and gas reserves of 13 more, the statements are 6. So virtually this entire report is financial information and footnotes, whereas when I was first getting into auditing, I would say the financial statements and footnotes were only about one-third of the report. The other two-thirds was description of the business, pictures, and things like that.
And that's a reflection of the evolution of accounting principles?
Yes,
the,
it is.
Or the complexity of business also?
Yes, I would say it's a combination. Yeah, the complexity of business and more matters are now were then covered in accounting standards, and most of them require disclosure. And then in addition to that, of course, you have the SEC requiring increased amounts of disclosure. So it's a combination of all those factors.
Okay.
Probably also litigation is a factor.
Hmm.
Back when I started, it was sort of uncommon for an accounting firm to be sued.
Mm-hmm.
It was also uncommon for companies to be sued over the contents of their financial statements. Now, of course, it's become quite common.
Mm-hmm.
So companies are going to err on the side of over-disclosure.
Mm-hmm. And when do you think that started to change? When do you think was the turn when?
I would say the 1960s. There, one of the famous cases was Continental Vending, where the auditors were charged with participating in fraud.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly worried us. There were a number of other lawsuits in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, going all the way back, there was the McKesson-Robbins case in the late 1930s, which started the requirement to observe physical inventories.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say it was mostly 1960s started that trend towards greater disclosure and greater pressure on development of uniform accounting standards.
Right. So during the 60s, I guess you started out the 60s in New York, where you went on Arthur Young's SEC and Accounting Research Intern program.
Right.
Was that an important step in your career?
Yes, it was. Yes,
in which
it was.
Way?
We were starting, let me go back a little bit further than that. The profession started out with the CPA was expected to know everything about taxes, auditing, and everything else. Taxes became so complex that we decided, no, we need separate people who are just fully informed on taxes, and the auditors can be informed on that subject. In the 60s, we were getting to a situation where the SEC requirements were also becoming extremely complex. So we thought we needed at least a few technical consultants who would be fully informed on the SEC requirements and, for all that matter, accounting principal board and so forth. So I was selected to be one of those persons who would work with our national office people and learn from them, our lead partner in the firm, learn from them about SEC matters and accounting principles matters.
So this is like your postgraduate specialization.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Right.
One of the things we did up there, I would mention, for example, when our senior technical partner would have conversations with other offices on SEC problems they were having, he would put it on the speakerphone. So we'd sit and join him and listen to the full conversation and his advice of what was happening. Another thing we would do is we would have, and this was in New York now, we were right down near Wall Street, We would have one of our secretaries go to each of the underwriting firms and pick up their latest batch of new prospectuses on new offerings. And we would get those in our intern group and review the all the financial information in them and index them, index any unusual item we had. So we had a card index. Again, this was before computers. Yeah. We had a card index of unusual accounting auditing accounting items that you would see in there. So we would have the experience of what other firms were experiencing with the SEC as well as our own experience. Mm-hmm.
And so while you were in New York, were you advancing progressively in your career? I mean, did you make a
yes,
partner in New York?
I became, in this first the first part there, I became a manager right away. Then I would mention also when I was in the national office and this SEC group working for our senior partner, I wrote an article for the Arthur Young Journal, July 63, called Disclosure and Summaries of Earnings. The summary of earnings, five-year income statement, so to speak, was always considered the most important part of the prospectus because it showed the registrants, the company's earnings trend. Therefore, practice had developed over the years to have various kinds of disclosures and various kinds of pro forma presentations to make that all that the SEC wanted it to be and all the underwriter wanted it to be. So what I did in this article was put together the different requirements for disclosing information in a summary of earnings. The information was taken from both experience and from various accounting series releases of the SEC and all carefully indexed together. Mm-hmm. Then after that brief national office experience, I was asked to be the lead SEC director in our New York office, and that was from 63 to 71.
Okay. Now, if I can ask you just really quickly about this this article that you wrote. At this time, was it necessary for someone who wanted to advance in their career to write articles like that and to publish, or was it just something that you did because you were interested in it?
It wasn't necessary to publish anything, I would say, or particularly if you were a partner engaged in full-time in audits. But in a position like I was in, I thought it was a good idea to do it, and it was something needed.
Right.
And I think it gave me some writing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the article I wrote, of course, although I made the first draft,
right.
I had lots of good editors
that
helped me out, so I think I learned a lot about writing an article.
Yeah, I can imagine, because you also continued writing articles.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
Yeah. But okay, and then so you became the SEC report unit leader at the New York office.
In New York office, right?
That's right. Okay. Yep. And
in that capacity, I of course review all of the SEC filings of all of the New York office clients, which were numerous. I mean, Mobile, RCA, American Machine and Foundry, and so forth. So I would look at all of the 10-Ks, the annual reports, the S-1 registrations, and so forth. And offer comments on them to our engagement teams, so we made sure they were fully compliant with SEC requirements.
Now at this time, there were a lot of changes that were taking place in sort of the American business environment. I guess this was the beginning of the wave of mergers
that
the 60s is remembered for. What sort of challenges did that pose to you as an auditor?
Well, I would say almost every week, one of our clients was acquiring someone. Oh, I forgot that. Yeah, I would say almost every week we had a situation where a client was acquiring another company or merging with another company, and of course it gave rise to the question: is the transaction a purchase or a pooling of interest? Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, the rules were kind of ambiguous, and most transactions could be regarded as a pooling of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Under the pooling concept, the assets of the smaller company were not written up, the goodwill is not amortized, and so forth, and therefore companies were motivated to do stock common stock exchange kind of deals.
Mm-hmm.
Had they done only common stock, that would probably not have been a problem, but then they started to add in preferred stock, convertible debentures. The concept of transactions being part purchase, part pooling came about,
yep.
And all sorts of weird things were happening.
So as an auditor, how did you feel about this? Because like, on one hand, there were expectations from companies, but on the other hand, you knew that the lines were a little bit blurry at times.
We knew the lines were blurry. We could see practice. And generally speaking, the standard is generally accepted accounting standards, not what the auditor would personally like to see.
Right.
So,
did you feel that clients might shop around for different auditors? Do you think that was already a practice at this time?
That later became a practice, yes. If uh-huh. they didn't get the answer they wanted from their own auditor, they would call up another firm. And I would mention on the merger and acquisition, mm-hmm. this was probably when I started to become more acquainted with the SEC, because if the merger accounting was in any way questionable, we would take it down to the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, it was Andy Barr, chief accountant, and later it became Sandy Burton and later Clarence Sampson, to review the transaction with them and make sure that mm-hmm. they would accept the accounting we were proposing.
Yep. Now, this was about the time of the creation of the Accounting Principles Board.
Yes, the Accounting Principles Board came in early 1960s with a long list of things they wanted to work on.
Yep. From the viewpoint of a working accountant, did this seem like a positive development, or was it more worrisome?
Yes, it was, because we thought there was a not sufficient uniformity in accounting. We thought there was not sufficient specificity in existing standards. The existing standards were outmoded, not up with the times. So we thought the APB was the great white hope to solve all these problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you imagine in the early 1960s that you would one day be a member of the APB?
It never occurred to me. It never occurred to me.
Right.
I may have attended. I certainly worked with our senior partner who was on the committee, so mm-hmm. I knew what the board was doing, but I was just too busy doing things right in front of me to think about that.
Were you already active in the AICPA at this time? Or?
At that particular point in time, no. I was active in the sense of going to technical meetings and so forth, but I was not, as I recall, I was not on any other committee. I was on the firm's accounting committee, the firm's national accounting committee, mm-hmm. too, which met five or six times a year and went over accounting issues.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess by 1970, the issue of pooling had begun to come to a head to a certain extent, and the SEC was starting to push the APP to issue rules
yes.
governing accounting.
Yes.
Did you see this as a positive thing at the time? I mean, would this have been something that would have been welcomed by Arthur Young or by you personally?
Very definitely.
Yeah.
I think all of the firms wanted greater specificity mm-hmm. in accounting standards.
Right.
For one thing, in dealing with the client, if we could say to the client, the accounting standard says this, and that's your situation, mm-hmm. then obviously the client doesn't have much of an argument. But if we're dealing with some vague standard, the client says, you say it says this, I say it says this.
Mm-hmm.
And so by having more specific standards, I think all of the big firms thought, all the firms thought it would be better off.
Yeah. I think that I can see that, but I know that at some point during 1970 there was a lot of criticism of the rules that the APB did propose on the issue of pooling, and some firms began to criticize the APB's decisions, saying that they were too strict.
That happened. But I think you have to look at that in the context of everything the APB had done prior.
Uh-huh.
For example, if you go back to the beginning, the first thing, big thing they really handled was the investment credit.
Mm-hmm.
The board then proposed that the credit be deferred and amortized over the life of the property that it related to.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed like very sound accrual accounting. Put out the standard to that effect. Lo and behold, the SEC, probably under pressure from elsewhere in the government, decided they cannot insist on only the deferral method of accounting, but they would accept also the flow-through, recognize immediately method of accounting. So they undercut the board, and the board was had to rescind that requirement right off the bat. The board then moved on to some easier things to do, like a source and application of funds statement. It had never been officially required under any accounting rules. And in part, that was in response to the financial analysts saying, if you can't give us uniform accounting, at least give us good information on cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, we'll give you cash flow. Then they moved on to leases on the lessee side.
Mm-hmm.
Should the airline, for example, have to capitalize a lease of an aircraft?
Mm-hmm.
The board came up with a test called the material equity test. Many additional leases were capitalized, but an awful lot of them fell through the crack and weren't capitalized. As a matter of fact, when the board went on to deal with the lessee from the lessor side, that might be the bank or finance company that owns it and is leasing it out,
mm-hmm.
the board was much more liberal in letting the leases be capitalized by the lessor as a receivable, as an
mm-hmm.
asset. So that immediately put leases sort of out of sync.
Right.
The board then, and I think there was dissatisfaction with the board on the matter of leases. Pension cost, tough problem. The union pension plans becoming more generous. A lot of unfunded past service costs not being recognized in the statements. The board, I think, made a very notable effort to deal with that with an extensive opinion. But it also did not put all of the unfunded liability on the balance sheet. It took the FASB to do that many years later.
Mm-hmm.
In number nine, dealing reports of operations, many companies prior to that, if they had any big loss they didn't want to highlight, they would treat it as a special item. It would come out down to ordinary operating income, and then they would have a special item kind of below the line.
Right.
In effect, saying, stockholders, please ignore this. This was an accident. It'll never happen again. Well, the board thought that was being abused, and those special items should be moved up into net income. That item should not be run mm-hmm. through surplus, for example.
And that passed
without 2 months controversy. The next one to create a lot of controversy was the board dealt with a very narrow subject of whether, when convertible debt is sold, whether the conversion privilege should be assigned a separate value. Let's say the convertible, just a piece of the debt is sold for $10,000. With a privilege to convert into so many shares of common stock anytime in the next 10 years. The conversion privilege obviously has value, and for that reason, the convertible debt would sell a low interest rate. The board said maybe companies should be assigning part of this value they received, the $10,000, so much to the warrant, the conversion privilege, say $150,000, and the rest of the debt. And after you assign the rest of the debt, that would impute the interest rate on the debt from 4% up to 6%. Well, Wall Street didn't like that. This was getting in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So they objected. The board came back and took a look at that and decided, well, I guess we haven't figured out how to value options yet, stock options, so it probably is not reasonable to require companies to value the conversion feature of a debt. So they dropped that.
So when Wall Street didn't like something that the APB was considering, what did they do? Who did they call? They usually just. I mean, they call.
They would complain to the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
They would complain through the Financial Executives Institute.
Right.
And obviously, we as auditors would hear it directly from them.
Was there
I think we felt we had to Some of the items, like the convertible debt accounting, kind of slipped through. There was not, I don't know that there was an exposure draft on it. Mm-hmm. It was slipped through with a lot of, without a lot of due process. And industry demanded due process. If you're going to do something, at least give us warning, give us a chance to comment on it. And in many cases, the board had to agree that there wasn't as much due process involved in getting the standard out. Mm-hmm. So that's how they made their... Well, I would say also in the case of leases, they wrote their congressman. The clients and bank investment bankers would write the congressman and say the APB statement on leases is going to make it difficult to for airlines to acquire mm-hmm. aircraft, which we need to keep the system going. Yes. Or in the case of oil and gas, it'll make it difficult for oil companies to drill for oil wherever they want to.
Yeah.
So that happened also.
So we're in the late 1960s at this point. Were companies already talking about, say, antitrust suits against the APB?
I don't recollect that specifically, but that was probably a threat, some mm-hmm. sort of a suit. And I think that's when the... that's when AICPA reacted and said, well, we need two study groups. We need a group to be headed by Bob Trueblood, an mm-hmm. eminent CPA from Touche Ross, mm-hmm. to head up a study of the objectives of financial statements. And then we need another committee to study the establishment, the board, what kind of a board, how should accounting standards be adopted? That to be chaired by Frank Wheat, mm-hmm. who at the time, I believe, was a former SEC chairman. So those two gentlemen undertook those two tasks to come up with the two studies.
Mm-hmm. So the industry, the accounting industry, was supportive of these these initiatives to deal with the problem?
The accounting industry really started them. But I would say they started them really with some urging by industry mm-hmm. That industry should play a bigger role.
Right.
For example, at our APB meetings, there was one industry member. Exposure drafts were sent out to industry. If we had task forces on a particular topic like oil and gas, it would generally be made up from people from the accounting profession that mm-hmm. we could get our hands on to do the work.
Right.
And industry would not be well represented in those. So industry thought that the system should have greater representation mm-hmm. From industry.
Now, in cases like the Wheat Committee, I mean, the Wheat Committee ended up recommending the establishment of an independent board.
Yes,
the FASB.
Yes,
it seems interesting that the accounting industry would have supported an initiative that basically took the power out of its own hands.
Mm-hmm. There were mixed feelings about it. First of all, the cost for the AICPA to deal with all of these accounting issues in terms of added staff, more meeting time, travel time, everything like that, was becoming larger and larger and larger as we took more on our agenda. So the AICPA would have had to pass that cost on in membership fees.
Right.
And many members would say, industry is presumably getting the benefit of all the work we're doing. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't they help pay for it? So I think industry was receptive to the idea that if you have an independent board, they would chip in, which of course they did, through the Financial Accounting Foundation mm-hmm. to help pay for the FASB. So I think the AICPA... on the one hand, they would have liked to be in the business, but on the other hand, the business would be becoming too expensive, too difficult. They recognized they probably needed full-time members, not mm-hmm. just six times a year
right.
member like I eventually became.
Because, of course, this was costly not only in terms of money, but also in terms of the time of the individuals involved.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. As you would find out yourself very soon.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So why don't you tell me, how did you become to be a member of the APB?
Probably because of my background and the fact that I'd worked closely with our prior member on the board, mm-hmm. Who was retiring.
Yep.
I was selected. I was also in New York. and the board usually met in the yard.
Who was the prior member on the board?
The prior member on the board was Frank Weston.
Okay, yeah. And you knew him?
I knew him quite well.
Okay, yeah.
So I was sort of recommended by a number of people as someone mm-hmm. who would largely fit into that role. I knew what the board was doing. I had worked with Frank.
Were the members elected?
The members were appointed, one from each big eight accounting mm-hmm. firm, and then probably three or four from mid-size accounting mm-hmm. firms, and then one would be an industry rep who was usually picked by the Financial Executives Institute mm-hmm. Committee. Another would be a financial analyst, if we could find one, and another would be an academic.
Okay.
Professor Chuck Horngren in this case, was on the board. The members from the individual Big Eight firms, it was basically one from each firm. The firm could take their pick.
Yep. And so, let's see. So at this time, Mr. Wheaton, if someone came to you and asked you, would you like to serve on this board?
The managing partner of our firms nominated me, basically. Uh-huh. He said, we'd like you to do it.
Now,
I said, go, yeah, I'll do it.
And
my board went to the Institute, and since it came from the managing partner in our firm, the Institute, of course, wouldn't question it.
Now, it was the Wheat Commission already busily working on their report that would basically... advocate the
They were at the time working on it. We weren't certain, of course, they would advocate the end of the APB and start of a full time board. Mm-hmm. But I think we realized that was the likely course of action that was going to happen as we approached our agenda.
But there was no worries that your service on this board would affect your career negatively in any way, right?
I didn't think so at my young age. Now, someone in the firm who was older might have thought otherwise, mm-hmm. was handling big clients, might have thought otherwise, but in my situation, I was still in the learning process. Mm-hmm. I think you're forever in the learning process in accounting.
Were you already a partner at this point?
I was a partner at that point.
What year did you make partner?
1968.
Okay.
So this was 70.
So you were a junior partner.
72, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, it's very interesting to me that in the last year and a half of its life, the APB issued 10 or 11 rulings, mm-hmm. which was nearly one-third of its total output during a life that stretched over a period of almost 10 years.
Right.
So why such activeness if the board was on its way out?
We had... a chairman, Phil DeFleece from Coopers & Lybrand, who was a very energetic chairman who believed that we should do everything we could possibly do to make it easier, perhaps, for the FESB when they took things over. But there was also going to be a recognized gap interval between... when we finished and when the FASB started up. We knew the SEC would not be comfortable with nothing happening in terms of accounting standards. So Phil said, basically, full speed ahead, let's do everything we can.
Okay. And so what issues did you decide to tackle first?
The sequence was first of all to... clean up the standard we had, APB we had on accounting disclosure of accounting policies. This was something that had been done, disclosure of accounting policies was something that had been done on kind of a fragmented basis before in financial statements. Statements might disclose a company's on LIFO, the LIFO method. They might say it had accelerated depreciation methods and so forth, but never were the policies put together in one single footnote. So this requirement was to put all those diverse policies together in one footnote so a financial analyst or someone else could then make their own evaluation of what the impact is of different policies. Now, the financial analysts would have liked to have seen some computation of the effect of each policy a company used against against every other policy it might use. That would be a huge mathematical table. We quickly decided that was not possible, so we would just have a narrative. We then moved on to clean up a couple areas of deferred taxes, which I think don't require any special attention. But we also had the investment credit, which we had not been satisfactorily resolved in the past.
This had also been a controversial issue.
This had been controversial going all the way back to the start of the APB in 1961. The investment credit was, of course, still allowed under the tax law. Most companies were flowing it through income in the year they got it. Some would defer and amortize it over future years. We thought there should be a single standard. We discussed it with the SEC. The SEC said they would support a single standard. And so we came up with a single standard that says the investment credit should be deferred and amortized over the life of the related assets. And that was supported by the board by, I would say, 2-to-1 margin. There were 4 or 5 dissenters. And I can still recall the meeting in which we were about to vote on that. And Philip DeFelice was leading the meeting. And Dick Lytle, the lead staff person for the Institute, interrupted and said, I have a phone call here from Washington. And Phil said, well, what's it about? And Dick said, we understand that Senator Benson has just introduced an amendment to the Internal Revenue Code that would say no company shall be required to defer the investment credit if they don't want to. And then the message went on to say that amendment has just passed. And Phil put the pile aside and said, well, let's go on to something else. That was the end of that discussion, but I think it was another reminder that we always had to take into account the political input, as the FASB has found out also. We were also dealing with oil and gas accounting at the time.
It's also a very political issue.
Very, very political issue, and we could see that one, and we decided that was a good one to defer to the FASB. Marketable equity securities was a very interesting one. Basically, many conglomerates, ITT was one example, were acquiring insurance companies at that time. The insurance companies, of course, would have large portfolios of common stock. The common stocks would be generally carried at cost. Therefore, that put the company into a position of causing an instant profit by merely selling a stock. Even though the market generally might be going down, they sell one with a low cost basis and have a gain. The gain would then go into their income statement. That additional income would give them a total 10% income increase for the year. So in any event, there was a feeling that marketable equity securities needed to have some tension. So we looked at different alternatives, put them all on market, leave them on cost. If they're on market, should we amortize the appreciation slowly into income, which Chuck Ornan used to call smoothing, or should we let it flow through only when capital gains occurred, which some others called the yo-yo system?
Did you reach a decision?
We didn't reach a decision.
The decision we reached that this issue
is so intertwined with current value accounting, and we have the True Blood Committee looking into the basis of financial reporting and presumably current value accounting. This was just not the right time to jump into that. It would be premature. So we let that one go for the FASB to take over. Foreign currency translation. The problems that had arisen in the early 70s when the dollar was allowed to float had somewhat alleviated. So we thought that would be a good one to hold over to the FASB as well.
Now, this was, of course, an issue that was that must have been very dear to your heart, because you published an article on the subject in, I believe, the Harvard Business Journal in 1970.
Right, in 1970, when the
72.
Yeah, when the dollar was first floated, meaning the dollar, the exchange rate with Deutschmark, Swiss franc, Dutch guilder, and so forth. Those exchange rates were no longer pegged, and therefore, with kind of high inflation in the U.S. at the time, those currencies were appreciating in value against the dollar. Now, this is a situation which we had never had happen before. We were usually dealing with other currencies, South American particularly, depreciating against our currency. Mm-hmm. So we needed to look at that and did, and I suggested a proposal related primarily to the U.S. company that would have a pretty much autonomous subsidiary in Germany doing business strictly in Deutschmarks, including even with Deutschmark long-term debt. Now, under the old standards, the traditional approach would be to translate the value of the German assets from Deutschmarks into U.S. dollars at the rate that prevailed when the assets were acquired. That was sort of historical cost accounting. But on the liability side, then the argument was, the argument on the liability side was that, well, that should be translated to the current rate. So the assets would stay where they were, the liability would go up, there was a loss. Well, we stood back and looked at that and said, how can you have a loss when this German subsidiary that operates in Deutschmark is going to keep making the same Deutschmark earnings they did before, and Deutschmarks are worth more in U.S. dollar terms? How can this generate a loss? So we thought more of an overall economic look out of it. Taken, and that led to that article I wrote for the Harvard Business Review, and the APB later decided that the accounting that came out of that process would hold us over till the FASB could undertake that.
Okay, well, we were just talking about stock compensation. What was the APB doing on this at the time?
Well, the old accounting research committee of the AICPA had dealt with stock compensation to some extent in prior years. Mm-hmm. But since that date, a number of new types of stock plans, stock option plans, had been developed. So the old standard was just inadequate to deal with the subject. And the board was attempting to come up with a standard that would cover all the new plans.
Were there any particular cases at this time that had come out in the news, or was it just a general issue?
I don't think there were any scandals or things of that nature. I think the SEC was getting nervous that there were so many unique kinds of stock plans that were not being accounted for. Mm-hmm. See, under the old standard, if you gave the stock to an employee, an outright grant, it would be charged to compensation at the fair market value of the stock. That was pretty clean cut. Mm-hmm. However, at the time, if the stock had restrictions on it, companies would discount it to a lower value for compensation purposes. And the SEC was getting nervous about, and others, that those values were just unrealistically low. Also, the old standard only called for charging compensation to expense on an option if the option was at less than the current market value. The current market value is $10. The employee gets an option to buy it at $8. There's $2 worth of compensation. But the more traditional option then, the qualified stock options, he would get the option to buy it at $10 in the now market. So the then accounting was no compensation charge. But then as additional variations were added on to those kinds of plans, for example, to have the price of the option decrease over time or other variations, companies were not charging compensation. It was obvious that they were giving away a lot of value to employees, and the board was attempting to deal with it.
So what did the board decide, Tom?
Well, the board evaluated whether to use the fair market value, the fair value of the option itself as a measure of a charge to income, or whether to adopt some variation of the old standard. Some of us thought the best approach would be to require a valuation of the option itself, just like investment bankers can value warrants, mm-hmm. put a value on it, though someone ought to be able to put a value on an option, charge compensation for that. That idea was not too popular in industry, obviously, because it would involve significant charges to income. Also, we recognize that the ability to value options was quite difficult. There would be a lot of non-uniformity if we were to require that, and that perhaps we were ahead of our time, and we should merely change the existing standard to say that the compensation amount is measured when the number of shares is known and the option price is known. So if the number of shares being granted was in any way adjustable up or down, then the compensation would not be measured until the final number of shares was determined. Likewise, if the option price were adjustable up or down, the compensation would not be measured till a later date. Mm-hmm. So the effect of that would be for certain types of plans, called phantom stock plans, variable option plans, and so forth, to require a significant compensation charge of income, and that's the way we moved that one forward. I thought it was, on balance, a good opinion, but I think the better approach would have been to value the option, which is what the FASB did when they dealt with the subject many years later.
Okay.
The one I was the chairman of, every topic had a subcommittee, and every subcommittee had a chairman, to try to gather the information needed for the standard, was one called non-monetary transactions, which some of the members jokingly called trade in accounting. If you traded in your car and you only paid another $1,000 plus the trade-in, then your purchase of a new car was $1,000, so to speak. The tax law would permit something close to that. And that was frowned upon as not being, not recognizing current values of what was being exchanged. Oil companies were exchanging oil interest to serve their own strategic purposes. We even had companies like meat packing companies exchanging entire meat plants to go from one line to the other. And of course, in sports teams, we had teams trading players and so forth. So the basic question was, were those exchanges of the type where we should look at the value of each side of it and decide the value of what was being exchanged? And of course, the flip side of that would be if you developed a player, if you are a sports team, you develop an outstanding player. He's probably on your books at a basis of zero because you deferred no cost for him. If you can trade him to some other team for a $1 million player, then should you have a $1 million gain because you got rid of a player on your books for nothing and you get a $1 million player for it? Well, the joke was, what if someone is swapping their $2 million cats for $2 million dog? To make a long story short, most members were nervous about recognizing current value, since that would lead to recognizing gains or losses on exchanges. So we limited the cases where value might be recognized, and that would be, for example, where you're swapping marketable securities for a building.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're merely swapping a building for a building, that would be a type of exchange where you would merely take the old asset off the books at the cost basis it was on, mm-hmm. and then bring in the new one at the same cost basis. No gain or loss.
And under this ruling, who would be responsible for assessing the value? Would it be the
if you used a value in an exchange, you'd perhaps bring in an appraiser.
Mm-hmm.
But in the usual case, most of the swaps being dealt with here were like-kind property exchanges. Mm-hmm. So there was no need to revert to value. Mm-hmm. And I would add the fact that Trueblood Committee was, we knew they would look at value accounting. We thought we would be premature if we required value widespread for for these particular transactions, not knowing how the True Blood Committee would come down on that. Mm-hmm. Yep. This was also closely related to another standard that was under consideration on real estate transactions. There had been a number of cases which the SEC became aware of and issued releases on, dealing with often year-end sales of real estate at large gains by the seller. And sometimes those transactions in December, which added to the company's profits, would get unwound. You know, the buyer decided he didn't want to keep the property. He walks away from it, so the seller got the property back again. So a committee was established, another committee, industry kind of committee, to deal with accounting for real estate transactions. And my job as an APB member was to coordinate with them, see what they're doing, read the results of what they come up with, and try to translate it into a readable kind of accounting standard, which we did. The net result was to prescribe various levels of down payments that would be required in order for the seller to recognize a gain on the sale of property. That was what some people call the cookbook approach, specifying numbers. And another curious thing happened. Some argued that the auditor should be able to make a judgment, the accounts, on the collectability of the receivable if you sell real estate, like they do for everything else. But our real estate experts were saying, well, the problem is that if you give up a note, a mortgage, and take the property, you can always walk away from the property in most states and just give it back. So it gets unwound. And the question was, do you mean even if General Motors sells even if you sell a piece of real estate to General Motors, General Motors is going to have to put down a 10% payment for us to recognize that gain? And the real estate folks said, yeah, they should be required. And of course, it's interesting to see what has happened to General Motors. Right. We looked at General Motors as the highest standard of quality of whether a receivable is collectible or not.
Mm-hmm. Things do change, I guess.
Things change. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There were a few other items we cleaned up. Not particularly controversial, interim reporting, mm-hmm. and whether the gain or loss from extinguishment of debt should be recognized immediately. Mm-hmm. Right. It should.
Overall, how did your experience at the APB compare to what you expected? Was it about...
I would say it's a very collegial organization. I would say we're all talking about doing the same things, trying to improve accounting. There were no sides or anything, mm-hmm. this firm against that firm. I would say that all the members, when they got into those meetings and their discussions, if they had some involvement with some client, they would take that hat off and look at all these matters very objectively. Yep. Of course, in the usual situation where there are alternative methods, I might have a client that has method A, another B, another C, another D. You know, we can't come up with a standard that pleases everybody. So we basically would pick out the one we thought made the most sense.
Yeah. So you were selected by your firm to participate
yes.
on the board. Did you feel like you were a representative primarily of the firm, or that you were pretty independent?
The understanding was I was a representative of the firm.
Right.
So I would refer issues that came up back to our
right.
firm accounting committee, which I mentioned, which I'm a member of. And I would make the case for what I thought was the best approach.
Okay.
And we'd go around the table and basically take a vote. I would say in most all cases, we were in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of my opinions were qualified in some respects. For example, on stock option accounting, I thought there should have been, we should have used values.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I voted for the standard. But generally, it was at least I knew I was there as a representative of the firm.
Mm-hmm. Was do you think the firm was ever concerned about what would happen if the opinion of a of their member on the board got back to clients, for instance, on the questions of stock options?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could imagine this.
I would say no. I would say no. I think the basically we could not come up, because of diversity in the county, it would be difficult for to come up with a standard that would please every company out there, every client you have. So there's going to be some client highly pleased with some standard and another kind of unpleased and some others in between. So basically we just called them as we called the shots as we saw them.
Okay.
And in some, well, also I would make a point if I knew on foreign currency. To get better informed of that, I would talk to our folks at PepsiCo or our folks at Mobil Oil through the client team,
mm-hmm.
to get their perspective. So I made sure that they were at least heard.
I guess that's important because you need to understand how this is actually working for companies out in the real world.
That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah, the devil is, as Ross Perot once said, the devil is in the detail. You have to get in the details to determine, and that's really what happened on the convertible debt.
Okay.
The board came up with a good theoretical standard that you could work out of the blackboard, but when you try to deal with it in practice, there were too many complications to make it work.
Okay. What was it like to put out the light at the APB? I mean, what did you all have an end of an era party?
I think we had an end of the era party. There were mixed emotions. There were mixed emotions. We knew that it was the consensus opinion to proceed with the FASB. And as I say, I had another job.
Right.
I sort of visualized I might not have to work as many 12-hour days as I did with the APB. And so I think everyone thought that would be a move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Institute had to reevaluate, well, what are we going to do in the area of accounting standards now that we don't have the APB? And that led to the formation of the Accounting Standards Executive Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that was a committee of representatives of the Big Eight and a number of other firms. I think we got a total of about 15. To address accounting issues.
Was this before the end of the APB or
this was right after.
Okay, so
right
this
after
is,
it was
so
over.
Successor.
This was to be a sort of a successor committee with a very uncertain prospectus. This is what we're supposed to do.
Right.
Some of us thought that perhaps we could issue interpretations of the old standards. Opinions we'd already issued, but the FASB said no, those would be binding accounting standards. You can't do that. We have that job now. So we set aside interpretations and basically come up with the idea of a position paper. A position paper would merely express our views. It would be stated not to be binding on members of the profession to follow it, but it was good guidance. And quite often we knew the SEC would probably require it in practice. And also we would direct all of those position papers to the FASB for consideration. And in many cases, they would take those standards and adopt them, those position papers, and adopt them almost verbatim. In other cases, they would change them around a little bit.
So ideally, these position papers would be issued before the FASB would make a ruling.
Oh, yes.
Right.
These would be very fairly narrow subjects that the FASB didn't want to tackle right away.
Yeah.
They were dealing with big issues like research and development, and of course they were going to take on foreign currency, and they were going to take on oil and gas accounting, and they were going to take on leases. So the big ones, they wanted, the FASB wanted to give those the highest priority. These little narrow ones, they were happy, I think, to have the ACSEC, as we call it, come up with a position paper that would sort of set a practice and a direction and get us through for a while until they could deal with it.
Did the ACSEC, so it started right after the APB ended in 1973, were you involved with it from the beginning?
I was on the very first ACSEC for, I think it was about a three-year period. So I was in there during that formation period. Another thing ACSEC did, besides the position papers, is we would read all of the FASB discussion memoranda and exposure drafts and so forth and comment on it. We would have a, I can remember the FASB proposal on leases, which would have required fairly extensive capitalization. That being discussed by our committee, and I can recall because I was sort of a subcommittee of our exec committee to deal with the response to the FASB, we came up with a view that was, I think, a majority favored capitalization of all finance leases, which would mean more extensive capitalization than before. But there was a minority that thought that didn't have to go that far, and then there were others who said we ought to capitalize all leases, large, small, long, short, capitalize them all. Don't try to draw a line. So I went to the FASB public hearing. That's something the FASB instituted that we at the APB never, basically never used, was a public hearing. So I went to the public hearing to present the ACSEC position on leases, and they basically said, well, what do you have to say? What's your committee's position? And I said, we do not have a majority position, a unanimous position, but the half favor capitalization of finance leases.
Okay.
That is ones where the present value of the rentals is at least 90% of the cost, basically the formula, the FASB. So I said that's where the majority of the ACSEC comes down, but we don't have a two-thirds majority. I mentioned where the minority view was. So basically we did that also. We inputted into the FASB on all the material the FASB was putting out, as well as dealing with these narrow issues through position papers, and that kept us very busy.
Right. Okay. Now, about this time in your career at Arthur Young, there were also some big changes, right?
You mean later on in the merger, or?
Well, I mean, I guess in 1978 you were.
'78. I had been in the position of the director of accounting for the firm for several years, in the various technical posts before that. One thing that was happening in the profession was the notion of course, some people talked about rotating audit firms. A company should have an auditor for 7 years and go to another new firm. Well,
what did you think about this?
That would have been horrendously costly because the time required to bring the audit firm up to speed on a new client is very significant. It involves a lot of cost also to the client because the client has to provide a lot of new information that the prior firm had, let's say. So solution to that was, well, let's at least rotate the senior partner on each of the major engagements after some period of time, like 8 years. So it, kind of in the context of that, I was looking for some new challenge. And we needed a partner on the West Coast to handle one of our major aerospace clients out here. So they suggested I might do it.
Which client was that?
That was Lockheed. And, of course, part of the background is I had had this experience with the AICPA Committee on Relations with the CASB, Cost Account Standards Board.
And what was that?
The CASB was a board created in the government to deal with cost accounting standards for government contractors.
And that, so this was your first exposure to defense-related issues?
In that committee, that was really my first exposure to defense contract reimbursement kind of issues. See, these were standards that were not designed for the financial statements of the contractor, but designed for the cost data that the contractor provides to the federal government when it negotiates a contract or when it has a fixed price contract with the government or a cost plus contract. So I had that background, so I became sort of a natural choice to come out to Los Angeles and head up that particular engagement. And in the process, I ended up heading up several other companies, one a major agricultural company, another a cargo airline company, another major biotech company.
Your work on the Lockheed account took you abroad as well, right?
Yes, it did. London, Saudi Arabia. They had major operations over in Saudi Arabia. Spent a week there, visited the various locations. Mm-hmm. And the auditor does that primarily to make sure they have a good feel for what's happening in these overseas operations.
Was this your first international work?
That was my first international audit work of significance. Now, back in Pittsburgh in my auditing days, various of our clients had overseas subsidiaries, and they were usually small. We usually had the foreign office do the work. I would look at it. I would work on translation issues like that. But this was the first case where I had a major client with overseas operations where I actually went out and see what was going on.
So shortly after you were transferred to Los Angeles, you were appointed to the U.S. delegation to the International Accounting Standards Committee.
Yes.
How does one come to be appointed to the IASC?
First of all, the AICPA had the practice of rotating those chairmen, those memberships among the firms. So basically, you would serve a 3-year term, and then they would go to another firm for a representative. I succeeded a representative by the name of Joe Cummings, who was from Pete Mowick. Wally Olson, then chairman of the Institute, knew me from the APB days, knew I had some background on foreign currency accounting and foreign matters like that, and so asked whether I could do that for a 3-year term. Of course, it involves meetings about 5 or 6 times a year, generally over in London, generally 2 or 3 days.
So it was less of a demand on your time than your service on the APB?
Yes. Also, many of the topics we were dealing with were really repeats of the subjects I had dealt with on the APB, leases and pension accounting and many items like that were now coming up in the international area.
Well, you were on the APB previously. Did you attend any of the big international conferences on accounting, some of which led to the creation of the IASC?
The IAC was created, I think, was back around, 73. Now, I don't recall, I was not in on those conferences.
Okay, so you weren't following that as closely.
I was not really following that issue at that time. Mm-hmm. And when I was on the APB, it really never came up that much. The IASC was really just getting off the ground then.
Mm-hmm. So when you you accepted the offer to join the IASC, what did you expect to find there?
I didn't know. We had I think there's like 50 countries were technically member. Our members were members of it. There's probably more now. But a board is selected from about 15 of those countries, and they're usually the major industrial countries like U.S., Canada, England, Germany, France, South Africa, Australia, Japan. Mm-hmm. Others take turns on it, like Nigeria was on when I was there. Some other country may be on. But in any event, I think I knew enough about English and Canadian kind of thinking on accounting. Particularly the Canadian was very similar to the U.S. And I had dealt enough with our London office on different accounting issues that came up.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I could talk their language. I'd also had some dealings with our offices in France and Germany and some other countries.
Did you feel like the IASC was doing useful work and that it was contributing to the development of a body of international standards?
Yeah, I think it was the problem on an international basis is where we might have in a particular area, two alternatives here working to try to get it down to one. If you look at it internationally, there's probably like 6 possibilities out there. So it would be unrealistic to think we could go from 6 down to 1 method. So the IASC approach was to work the 6 down to maybe 2 or 3 acceptable ones, preferably no more than 2. with disclosure of the alternatives used, feeling that was a step in the right direction, and at some future date, the two or three could be narrowed down to one. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the approach we took. It's not looking for absolute uniformity, but basically narrowing the differences, and that's the way we went about it. Of course, I think the U.S. and the Dutch and the English kind of think the same on accounting. Those other countries are perhaps lean a little more towards current value kind of things, you know, appraising real estate and those kind of things.
There certainly must have been a lot to learn.
There was a lot to learn. Fortunately, yeah. All of this was done in English, so therefore there are no translators, so every representative there, Japan and every other country, had to be able to speak English, and did a very good job of it. We met in a chartered accountant's hall over there in London, where you could see plaques on the wall dating back to 1900 in the name of Pricewaterhouse and Pete Marwick and that.
Wow.
The name all the way back, it was the history of the accounting, all on the wall looking at you. So I think we made good progress. We've apparently made such great progress since then that the U.S. is thinking of adopting all IASC standards. I'm not sure it'll get there, but I never dreamed that would be happening. I knew it was a possibility.
It is truly a globalized world today, so there may be some advantages to that. At the time, though, while you were serving there, how were relations between the American accounting industry and the IASC?
They were very good. Matter of fact, one of the reasons I was on the Financial Accounting Standards Advisory Council that three-year period is because I was on the IASC, so I was sort of a pipeline between the IASC and the FASB.
Okay. Yeah.
So I knew what the FASB was doing. Generally, the IASC was lagging behind in terms of standards, so by the time the FASB had dealt with leases, the IASC had not gotten to it yet.
Right.
And therefore, there was sort of a tendency on the IASC, if the U.S. has a good standard and it's well documented, let's build on that rather than starting from scratch.
So the IASC often looked to the United States or maybe to Britain for example.
They would look to one of those three. The Dutch had their own ideas, but the Dutch were also in line also.
And the FASB wasn't worried at this time about competition from the IASC? Or
back in the APB days, no. It never occurred to them.
Yep. Okay, I did see one article about the IASC where it talked about what seemed to be a small dispute in 1970 and 1980 over whether the FASB would be allowed to send observer members to attend meetings of the IASC. I was wondering whether you remember that at all.
I don't remember. That was after my day, really. That was after my day. There was some talk about it. There was also a discussion of whether the U.S. representative on IASC should be someone from the APB. I think the APB thought
from the FASB?
I think FASB thought that would compromise their situation if they had to also address it through the IASC. So it worked out fine with myself and the other U.S. member there was a member from industry. So we and also Canada and some other countries sent not only someone from the auditing profession, but also someone from industry. I had a partner there first from ARCO, oil company, and then later from another large company. So we put our heads together and came up with a combined auditor, a business executive kind of view as to what the standard should say.
While you were at the IASC, did you have any contact with Henry Benson, who was one of the originators of it?
Yes, met him at a meeting.
What did you think of him?
Very nice gentleman. It was sort of an interesting meeting because it was an Arthur Young Professors Roundtable meeting. We sponsored, we are the young part that time, sponsored meetings between the different Arthur Young professors on different subjects once a year perhaps. In this case, it was on international accounting issues. It was over in London. I was there sitting right next to Don Kirk, the then chairman of the FASB, who was invited. And so it was sort of Sandy Burton probably was there. So it was an open discussion about international standards and that kind of thing. And Henry Benson, who had not been particularly involved in ISC in the last few years, was kind of expressing some disappointment that the U.S. had not adopted all of these ISC standards. I whispered to Don Kirk, you know, I'm sure we're in conformity with every one of those standards. But I'm not sure that's necessarily true of the UK, for example, on some standards. Well, Don made a response to that, and Sir Henry Benson said, well, I guess I'm not quite up to date. But to sum it up, he was a gentleman, certainly one of the leaders of the profession in England and the worldwide leaders. But but yes, the FASB was in the international loop of things,
right,
as so things developed.
They were well informed.
Yeah.
Were any of the standards that the ISC issued during your time there, I mean, are there any of those you'd like to comment on? There's the
one interesting one, just to take one example, was segment reporting.
Mm-hmm.
APB had looked into that. Of course, the FASB came out with something also. The SEC had always wanted income information broken down by segments. So the IASC proposed something of that nature. The U.S. position basically was, if we voted for that on the IASC, we were going to get that adopted here if it wasn't already adopted. The only commitment, however, was for the IASC members use their best efforts to get it adopted within their own country. We visualized a situation, my other U.S. member and I, that if this standard on segment reporting went into effect in some country, which required a breakdown of the earnings of a Japanese subsidiary, and that were public information, a Japanese company subject only to Japanese standard might not have to do the same thing. So we suggested an effective date for the standard to be only when the standard went into effect for all companies within the country, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
So some areas like the segment reporting and disclosure of R&D, for example, other countries had trouble with that idea because of the thought that their companies thought they might be hurt competitively.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that the capitalization of development costs should be allowed or required, or what was your position?
Research and development?
Yeah, yes.
I thought it ought to be expensive as a matter of practicality. I think obviously companies incur R&D with a hope that it'll be successful. Some is, some isn't. It's unpredictable what will and what won't be successful. Referring to the biotech companies spent hundreds of millions of dollars at a time when no one was sure they would come up with anything commercially viable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turned out, they did. And if we were to Monday morning quarterback it, we could probably say they should have been capitalized in all that cost.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the usual experience with R&D is most of it's a loss, and you hope to get a few winners. You don't know which ones mm-hmm. are
going to
be.
Okay, good. What about foreign currency translation? Did the ISC try to tackle that at all?
They did, and they basically came up with an idea that was closer to what I proposed, except they, of course, put these currency adjustments through the equity section rather than through the income statement. But basically, they we would come up with a very similar result.
Mm-hmm. But it would be several years before they would actually act on it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, so over the course of the 1980s, your career at Arthur Young, you stayed in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Let's see, at this time you were the chairman of Arthur Young's Accounting and Auditing Standards Committee?
Yes, while out here, the person who had been chairman left the firm for a significant position in the industry. So they knew I was on the committee. Mm-hmm. And they thought I would be a good person to chairman that. Basically a matter of chairman in meetings, not running the National
right.
Office Accounting Auditing. And so I did that for a period of, I think, about 3 years.
Okay. Yep.
That would be meetings maybe six times a year in New York for a day or two to go over all of the hot issues on accounting
right.
and auditing within the firm. And
But that sort of puts you at the center of the action.
Right.
Right. Okay, and then you were still with Arthur Young in 1989 when it merged
yes.
with Ernst & Ernst.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. How was that experience viewed from the Los Angeles office?
I think that was a good experience viewed from any direction from both firms.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the merger, we ranked in size, maybe four or five, that neighborhood, let's say. We both kept incurring increasing costs for manuals, instructions, training, and so forth. And by being a larger firm, we could get the economy of scale mm-hmm. to work and not have to invest twice as much in training. We'd have the same training material.
Right.
Rather than they inventing their training material or inventing ours,
mm-hmm.
we'd invent one combined set of training material procedures,
mm-hmm.
have one office, and so forth. So,
were you involved in the integration of the offices in Los Angeles, or?
I was not the managing partner of the LA office at the time, nor was I involved in deciding which office we would move into. Let's call it. We selected the. I think they have made. Ernst & Ernst may have been in the same building, but I can't remember. In any event, we basically decided to move into the Arthur Young offices, which would be expanded by another floor, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was not that difficult because we were each doing the same thing. We each thought the same way. We
mm-hmm.
each had clients. We were each auditing basically the same way. We thought the same way. In accounting.
So you had very similar corporate cultures.
Yes, we did.
Yep. Okay.
Yes, we did.
Okay. And then, I guess, immediately after your retirement, you joined the CASB.
Yes.
That institution that so many years before you had worked with.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. And who asked you to join the CASB? How did you become involved in that?
When I was in Los Angeles, I headed up a group we call our Aerospace and Defense Industries Group, which was to promote training and services to our clients in that particular industry. So I had a group of people I work with, including some in Washington, D.C., who was a former staff member of the CASB, who knew what was going on in Washington. And he said to me, now that you're about to retire, why don't you take on that role or take a shot at it? I knew that a number of people would be considered. I, of course, had this background, first of all, working for the Committee for Relations, so I knew the people down there, and also had the industry knowledge from my experience on Lockheed and some other defense contractors. And I could present myself as someone who would not present a conflict of interest because I was about to retire.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the other people competing for the seats were active in their firms, consulting activities with government contractors, and arguably would have a conflict of interest if they were on the board making the rules and yet working with the clients and so on and so forth. So basically, that recommendation went that way. I talked to several, I was introduced to several representative in Congress who had committees relating to procurement matters, become acquainted by them. Mm-hmm. I talked to the man who was the head of the Federal Procurement Policy Office down there, got to know him. Mm-hmm. The Institute, the American Institute of CPAs, recommended myself and three or four other CPAs. Right. They were, of course, we're not going to pick out one.
Mm-hmm.
So basically it came down to they looked at my background, mm-hmm. the lack of conflict of interest, and
right.
picked me.
So tell me about the issues that you dealt with while you were there.
Many of the same ones we had at the APB and the FASB, you might say.
Wow.
Pensions was certainly a big one. They had dealt with it before, but there were more issues coming up, how to deal with actuarial gains and losses. Mergers acquisitions was another. If a defense contractor that has government contracts is acquired by another business in a purchase, and for accounting purposes, its assets are stepped up to a higher cost, should the price of contracts to the government go up by virtue of this accounting mm-hmm. adjustment? So we dealt with that issue and came up with, I think, an interesting compromise,
mm-hmm.
Which I think worked. Dealt with a number. I think we were beginning to look at post-retirement health benefits, which was something that had not even, I think it had just been addressed by the FASB at that time. We, of course, had previously dealt with issues of depreciation. Most of the work there really relates to allocation of overhead mm-hmm. to government contracts.
Right.
For a government contractor, all costs, including general administrative expenses, allocated mm-hmm. is allocable to contracts. So it's a full absorption cost system.
Yeah.
So a lot of the work relates to cost accounting formulas mm-hmm. for allocating this cost to first of the various units and then to the various contracts.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that though you spent most of your career in the private sector, you both started
yeah.
and ended your working life
yeah. Yeah,
serving the public.
Yes. I also looked at it in that direction. I was there, of course, for the last 2 years of President Bush and the first mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years of President Clinton, working in the old executive office building right next door to the White House. So
mm-hmm.
that was sort of a thrill, I guess you'd call it.
Did you move to Washington part-time?
Didn't have to, because, again, that was a 6 meetings a year, 2 day each, a lot of work done by mail.
Mm-hmm.
That was before I was into email.
Yeah.
I'm not sure email was hardly around by 1990.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of work done by mail, phone, comments made, have meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, of course, had a staff.
Right.
Not as big as the FASB staff.
Mm-hmm.
They got support from the Defense Contract Audit Agency also.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very interesting board, very right. diverse board, member from industry, a fellow from Boeing, later from Texas Instruments, myself, a representative from GSA, Government mm-hmm. Services Administration, and of course the head of the Defense Contract Audit Agency,
mm-hmm.
and the other fellow was the head of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Mr. Hayes, are there any other issues you feel like we should talk about?
I might add just 2 cents worth on current value accounting.
Okay, absolutely.
Because that issue I mentioned kept coming up on the board and still keeps coming up.
Yes.
I was in a capacity in New York at the time. The True Blood Committee asked for views on objectives of financial statements, and someone said to me, some senior person said, I think you're the best person to make up this response to that. And that was a tough job. I had thought in terms of objectives of financial statements are to prepare them in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the objective of generally accepted accounting principles? Well, it's to prepare a financial statement. Well, you get kind of circular, so you have to step back even further and say, who are we preparing statements for and why, and what should be mm-hmm. in the statements? It seems to me the target audience was should be investors and creditors, and not diverse sources such as labor unions, government, economists, and things like that. Because if those parties want financial information, they can get special reports. So investors, creditors are our target audience. Why they need it? To make an assessment on the value of the company and its cash flows, using that information together with any other information they derive. In other words, financial statements are not the entire picture. They're just part of the picture. And what should be assets of the company? Should it be, a lot of companies say, our major asset is our employees, or it's our R&D, or it's our mineral reserves. Well, we don't have any of those on the balance sheet. And how do you get those on? They're very subjective. So I said it shouldn't be everything you can, that an economist might visualize as an asset. It should be those assets that arise from business transactions. In other words, business transactions, you acquire an asset, you have an asset to put on the books. That's your starting point. So it seems to me we should work from, I call it, transaction-oriented accounting, mm-hmm. not from appraise what you have
on the books.
Regardless, right. And then secondly, when you do that, the data should have some fairly high degree of reliability. Shouldn't be pie-in-the-sky values and so forth. That really led me back to saying historical cost accounting was probably the best way to go, except in obvious cases like a mutual fund where we know the value of all the assets and it's just a matter of looking it up in the newspaper. But in other cases, the value of assets in a diversified company is very conjectural and just too difficult, I think, to come up with reliable statements. So I would anchor accounting, continue to anchor it around historical costs based on transactions.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's likely to be the way forward?
I think it will continue to be. I keep reading about current value accounting, and some of the politicians even blame the subprime crisis on the accountants or accounting rules because apparently some would require you look at, you go to current value on collateralized mortgage obligation documents, let's say, even though there's no ready market for them. So I didn't go quite as far as the politicians to blame the subprime crisis on. But I think current value has to be, and current values has to be looked at very cautiously. I think it's fine to have them in footnotes, but I think the basic statements ought to be
historical,
the more reliable data.
Yep. Very good. Well, Mr. Hayes, thank you so much. You've had a fascinating career. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure to recall all of these events that went on, and I hope this contributes to the library. Okay. How do we do?